Okay, so let's get rolling with Ben Wink, the economy reporter at Business Insider. Hey, Ben, thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks so much for having me back.
I love this headline, poop is hot right now. You didn't write that, did you?
No. That was a collaborative effort with me and my editor. She carried that one across the finish line, but I couldn't say no to it.
The second part, of course, is blame soaring fertilizer prices. And we've been talking about this here for a variety of reasons, but what are you reporting on?
Yeah, so, you know, as we've seen over the past few weeks, Russia's invasion of Ukraine has dramatically lifted prices for all sorts of commodities, right? Ranging from nickel to obviously the obvious one for us, the everyday cost, it's gas prices. But it's also affected fertilizer. Russia is the world's biggest exporter of fertilizer. And so that's really hitting farmers pretty hard ahead of the spring planting season. And what we've started to see is the use of manure. You know, usually dairy farmers and farmers who work with livestock pay to have manure taken off of their hands. And now there are people coming to them and saying, hey, we'll buy this from you because it is an alternative to these really much more expensive commercial fertilizers.
So I heard somewhere, I don't know exactly how you do it, but I guess fertilizers, we know it, or at least in a lot of applications, is a product of natural gas. And obviously Ukraine and Russia are big gas providers, including natural gas, and that's where fertilizer comes from, huh?
Yes, and so natural gas is a critical component when it comes to making these commercial fertilizers. And so, you know, like you kind of alluded to, it's really this nasty cycle where natural gas prices are rising, and that's lifting fertilizer prices, along with the fact that fertilizer prices are already climbing because Russia was a major exporter, and the Russian government was saying to their fertilizer producers, hey, you know, you should stop exporting. So this is, you know, prices are rising for all these different reasons. There are all these strains on that market, and clearly farmers are looking to any alternative they can get, including animal manure.
I'll turn to my friend Steve Alexander here, if you can get next to your microphone, Steve, or maybe you know Ben, but I wonder if that's actually a better form of fertilizer because it's natural and it's not fertilizer, it's cow manure or whatever.
I believe you. It's been used for eons,
sure,
since the beginning of time. But it brings other issues with it at times. It's not as good, I don't think. Maybe not as efficient as a fertilizer as ammonium nitrate is, or nitrogen, other forms of that.
Maybe you don't get the same results. What do you know about all of that, Ben?
Well, so that's absolutely right. It's tough to get the same kinds of crop yields with manure as opposed to these commercial versions. And then there's also, you're running the risk of contamination. If that gets into groundwater or a nearby stream or a lake or anything, you know, that's something that you don't really have to deal with as much with the commercial fertilizers that were just mentioned. So you are running a risk, and it might not yield the same results. But at the moment, and with supply chains being as messed up as they are, it's more of a factor of, you know, what can we do to backstop this lack of fertilizer supply?
Yeah. And by the way,
are
we talking about Ukraine, or are we talking about in the United States?
This is in the U.S., yeah.
Okay, stay right there if you would. That's Ben Wink. He is with Business Insider. I also wanted to ask him about the Great Resignation, which you've heard about. We'll redefine that, but then also tell you what's happening with all of these workers. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch. We're talking to Ben Wink, an economy reporter at Business Insider. You also authored a piece about the Great Resignation, which is the decision, I guess, huh, Ben, by a lot of people to not go back to work. It's not that they don't have jobs. Maybe they could even use the income. But for various reasons, a lot of people just aren't going back. What are you reporting on that?
Yeah, so there's a really interesting study out from the San Francisco Federal Reserve, essentially demystifying this idea that the Great Resignation that we're seeing right now is this bizarre, one-off event. And so what's important to note is the data that we use to measure the Great Resignation, right? We look at the quits rate. And that is from a survey that started in the year 2000. So as far as recessions that we've had since, we only have the dot-com recession or the dot-com bubble recession of 2000, 2001, the 2008 recession, and then the current one, right? And the current jobs recovery has been so fast and so strong. And we also have this really unusually high quits rate, at least going back to 2000. What the San Francisco Fed said was, you know, if we actually extrapolate that data and kind of link it to data that goes further back, we had similarly high quitting in the late 40s and the 1950s, 60s, and even the 70s when we were recovering jobs so quickly. So to summarize, you know, yes, we do have extremely high quitting going on right now in our economy. And that includes people who, like you mentioned, are quitting their jobs and not going back to work, as well as people who have quit their jobs that maybe went to a different job. Maybe there's a few months in between, but the quit counts for people who both went to a new job and just quit the labor force entirely. But what this study essentially shows is, you know, we just haven't had a jobs recovery this fast since the 1970s. And that's why we're seeing so much quitting, because there's just so much scramble within the labor market.
And the people who are quitting, some of them I would guess, have quit their jobs. They're not retiring because they're too young, but they've just decided to live on less income. Maybe their partner, husband, or wife works. And then there's some people who are taking a retirement earlier than they would normally have, and they've quit as well. I don't know if that counts as a quit or a retirement, but boy, it's fascinating to me. It's interesting you say that this isn't all that unique, but it is. It's weird that the unemployment rate is that low, and there's all of these people on the sidelines. The wages are going up for a lot of these positions, but the people, you just can't get them off the dime. They won't take them.
Yeah, and I think, you know, when you look back at the last time we had quit rates this high, right, decades and decades ago, you can't even compare that economy with the one we're in right now, right? Right now we have remote work going on. We've got, you know, the virus is still a factor that people are factoring in. This labor shortage is somewhat unique in just how widespread it is. The kinds of jobs that we have right now are not the jobs that we had in the 1960s and 1970s. And people, you know, the way people moved during the pandemic as well, you know, a lot of people left cities and are maybe living somewhere where they don't need to be working, you know, maybe in a household and a couple. They only need one person to be working where someone else can stay home and maybe take care of the kids. So all of these factors that have really created this pandemic economy over the past few years, it's really interesting to kind of compare it, because there's just so little similarity between what we're seeing right now and the last time we had such a strong jobs recovery.
Services are roaring back. Just one other note here from you. Services are coming back, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's a really interesting split when you look at the beginning of the pandemic recession, right, where all these in-person services were struggling the most just because people weren't leaving their homes, and manufacturing was generally doing better. Whereas now we have all of these supply chain issues and material prices are going up. It's manufacturers that have actually seen growth slow a little bit since the war in Ukraine started. And services are doing much better because virus cases are lower. There are fewer economic restrictions. And we're all, you know, most people, I should say, are vaccinated.
It's funny, though, but those are some of the jobs, too. I'm glad to hear that, because it would seem to me like those would be the jobs that people would be least excited about going back to. I read services to mean clerking at a store or at a restaurant or at a hotel or someplace like that. And those jobs, I'm going to guess, don't pay that well, right? So I'm happy to hear that people are willing to go back and do those things.
Yeah, and they've seen some of the strongest wage growth, you know, over the past year or so, just because, well, for one, a lot of those jobs were minimum wage jobs, but also those are the businesses that had to rehire the most because they lost the most workers at the start of this. So, you know, those businesses have been raising pay pretty quickly, you know, pretty historic rate. And you know, as we've seen in some of these business surveys, hiring is starting to go a little bit better there.
It's nice to talk to you, Ben. We appreciate your help today. That's Ben Wink, economy reporter at businessinsider.com. Thanks, Ben.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
773 texted in to say, John, I am so sick of hearing that there are so many jobs out there. I'm a 55-year-old female with a pretty respectable career. I've been looking for 6 months. I understand that. I'm not surprised to hear that. I know of people like that. And they're not all 55. Some of them are 62 and some of them are 32. And I don't exactly understand when they say you've got your pick of the litter, why some people aren't just getting plucked up and why some people are having real trouble finding jobs at a meaningful salary, at a salary commensurate with what they used to earn. Boy, you lost that job and now it's coming back, or all these jobs are coming back. But if you're over a certain age, and that may be 50, you really feel like you're a dinosaur trying to get back in. And not only should it not be that way, but the reporting doesn't seem to reflect that. Well, keep that in mind. We're just reporting the big numbers. Those are individual stories. Greg McBride joins us now, Chief Financial Analyst at Bankrate.com. That's not why we called you today, Greg. Do you have anything to say, though, about what I just said?
Very well said. Nothing I can add, nothing I could say better. Nicely done, John.
Well, that concludes our conversation with Greg McBride, Chief Financial Analyst.
Leave on a high note, huh?
Bankrate. Two-thirds. You guys did another survey, Bankrate.com, about home ownership and why some folks aren't. What's going on there?
Yeah, affordability, really kind of surfaces to the top in terms of what's keeping non-homeowners from buying a home. About 2 in 3, just shy of that, 64%, say that an affordability factor is what's keeping them on the sidelines. It can be lack of income. It can be home prices are too high. It can be can't afford the down payment or closing costs. All of that's really interrelated. This big surge in home prices, could make that savings you've accumulated seem insufficient to make you feel like you don't have enough income to buy a home. But on a brighter note, nearly 3 in 4 adults, and this is homeowners and non-homeowners alike, 74% of adults still say homeownership is part of the American dream. And John, it outranks being able to retire, having a successful career, getting a college degree. All those things really kind of take a back seat. Homeownership still the centerpiece of what most Americans view as the American dream.
To the people who are having trouble affording it because they don't have the down payment or interest rates are too high, I also thought that a large percentage of the people who aren't buying houses now are doing so because there's less urgency. Younger people seem to be less interested in the acquisition of things. They want to do more. And I don't think home ownership is valued to them, as prized as it was with their parents' generation.
Not at the same age. It's still happening. It's just happening a little bit later. One of the things that we found is, when it comes to sort of pegging home ownership as part of the American dream, it was much higher for Gen Xers and baby boomers than it was for Gen Zers and millennials. It was 59% among Gen Zers, 65% among millennials, feeling that home ownership is part of the American dream. I think a lot of those same individuals 10 years from now will feel differently. And we've kind of seen that play out with millennials, who are now the largest home buying cohort out there. 10 years ago, there was a lot of gnashing of teeth in the real estate industry thinking, oh, man, millennials aren't buying homes at the same pace as their predecessors did at the same age. Well, the passage of time and you get to a certain age, you want a backyard and a garage. And sure enough, that's what we're seeing happen.
Our colleague here, David Hochberg, had some calculation or formula he was sharing with us, and that is a 1-point rise in interest rates, which we've seen since they're low, adds so many dollars to your mortgage, and therefore it actually knocks down the desirable purchase price of a house. So instead of everybody going after a house that's $375, now they're coveting a house that's $275. That's the affordability factor.
Yeah, one of the calculations I've done is that the run up in mortgage rates since the beginning of the year, what that has done to affordability is akin to a 15% increase in home prices. So on top of the already robust appreciation we've seen over the last couple of years, tack another 15% on there, because that's the impact that higher mortgage rates just in the last several months would have on somebody who's in the market looking for that home now.
So refresh my memory. This run-up was due to COVID and everybody wanting to get a different house. That's what started at least the housing crunch, right?
Well, if we back up, even pre-pandemic, we had record low levels of inventory even then. And then after the sort of initial quarantine period of the pandemic ended, yes, as you noted, people were reevaluating where they lived and how they lived, right? They wanted a place where they could work from home. If they had the ability to work remotely, they were no longer tied to a high-cost metro area. They could move someplace else. And so, yes, a lot of, you know, demand really surged. But supply, which had already been at record lows, got even lower because in a pandemic, those that weren't moving, they don't want strangers traipsing through the living room. So we saw fewer and fewer houses coming on market. So you get this massive imbalance between demand and supply, and that's what's driven home prices higher, but that's also led to the type of things we've seen with the, you know, lines stretching down the block at an open house, the bidding wars, and those type of things.
Yeah, boy, those seem like a long time ago, but it wasn't that long ago, and there were those stories of cars just lined up, some people buying houses they hadn't even seen. I would imagine that another mitigating factor now, almost more than that, is the lack of materials. Even though lumber is more available now, everything else that goes into a house seems to be on back order, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, including, you know, labor itself is in short supply. So, you know, we've had basically a decade of underbuilding. You say, well, how did we end up with such a supply shortage? And that was, you know, a slow, you know, it, over time, it just accumulated because we had a decade of underbuilding. Well, it's not something you just flip a switch, build a bunch of houses, problem solved. It's going to take a few years to fix that problem, a few years of robust building to fix that problem. And yet, as you noted, this, whether it's supply chain or just labor shortages, really kind of holding back the ability to build to the extent that would be needed to begin alleviating this inventory crunch.
There's no consolation to those who, according to your survey, aren't buying homes because it's an affordability issue. But man, if that population suddenly came to the market, there'd be an even tighter housing supply. Prices would go up even more. I mean, it's kind of a self-perpetuating thing here, isn't it?
That's what we've seen, yes. I do expect that one of the things that these higher mortgage rates will do, it will temper demand somewhat, not necessarily bringing it back into balance because demand so far exceeds supply, but it won't be as frenetic. And I think as a result, we'll see much more modest pace of appreciation. So those that are sidelined now, whether it's due to affordability or just inability to get an offer accepted, I do think that over the course of the next couple of years, you know, their income growth, progressing the career, you know, they can perhaps grow into some of those homes that, you know, today they'd be paying a pretty penny for, even if the price is much the same 2-3 years from now. But if they're making more money, it's less of a strain on the budget.
I don't remember when it was. Was it 2020 or sometime in 2021? My wife were kicking around the idea of getting a bigger house or a house just a little further out of the downtown part of the city. And we went to some open houses. And you'd go to an open house and there would be scores of people all walking around looking at it, hushed phrases and words shared amongst them because they don't want to say anything like, wow, I love this place, right? And everybody looking at each other sideways and rumors about, well, they've already got three asks or three bids in at $10,000 over ask. And it was just that sort of awful competitive energy if you were a buyer. I don't know that that's still going on out there, but boy, I sure do recollect that sort of thing, Greg.
Oh, absolutely. And it's, you know, I think certainly happening to a much lesser extent now, but you're still seeing a very competitive market in the sense that, you know, homes selling for above asking price or buyers feeling the need to waive inspections and those type of things. Yeah. And this FOMO home buying environment, you know, that's the type of thing that over time I think can really come back to bite you. One of the encouraging things we found in the survey was 72% of homeowners said they would buy their current home if they had it to do all over again. And so that level of what I would call no regrets home ownership, and that's what you want to aspire to. The novelty of the new home will wear off. The mortgage payments will not, and particularly at a time when supply is tight, prices are high, mortgage rates are rising. Very, very important not to stretch too far beyond what you can afford and because you don't want to be in a position where then you're stuck. You don't have much equity. You don't have enough equity to really get out of the place.
Right.
If your circumstances changed.
Greg McBride, Chief Financial Analyst, Bankrate.com. Always a pleasure, Greg. Thanks for your time.
Thanks a lot, John.
Time for more business news. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch, and with that today, Ryan Burrow.
Set your timers. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. Water Tower Place could soon have a new property manager. The Chicago Tribune reports Brookfield Properties is transferring the asset on the Mag Mile to MetLife Investment Management. The price tag on the deal has not been announced. Macy's announced last year it was leaving its space in the struggling mall. Whole Foods Market says it plans to open a new 66,000 square foot store on Chicago's Near North Side April 27th. The new store at 3 West Chicago Avenue is twice the size of the store Whole Foods is closing at 30 West Huron Street. And Illinois Attorney General Kwame Raoul is among 14 attorneys general calling on major banks like Wells Fargo, Bank of America, and Chase to eliminate overdraft fees on consumer accounts. They say the banks took in more than $11 billion in customer fees in 2019 alone, with the most vulnerable customers being the most impacted. That's your Wintrust Business Minute. I'm Ryan Burrow.
All right, now let's do the business of food on WGN with Steve Alexander.
Yeah, you and your guest were talking about a half hour ago, John, about the price and availability of fertilizer and how that, along with the cost of fuel and of seed and of pretty much everything, is making farming tougher here. And even under normal circumstances, you know, farming's really hard. And for Ukrainian farmers, circumstances aren't even close to being normal. Joining us again today is Nick Gordichuk, who farms about 1,500 acres near Kyiv.
We find mines in the field, or we find some rockets that did not explode because they were too old, maybe.
And he says until the war ends and the fields can be swept for bombs, there's not a lot of work that can be done.
Let's assume war stops tomorrow. We are already late for some crops. And it's not that you can just go into the field and start planting. In order to start planting on 15th, 20th of April, we should have started in March to prepare soil, to put fertilizer, etc.
Nick Gordichuk says not all of Ukraine's farming areas were hit by the Russians. He estimates about 25% of it, but there are other problems affecting all of Ukraine's farmers.
Some farmers are not thinking about planting. We don't know where we will sell our crops. At the moment, all the ports of Black Sea are blocked by Russians. For example, in normal year, Ukraine would be exporting 3 to 4 million tons per month of grains. Now we exported for last month only 800 to 900,000 tons, just a fraction. And of course, Ukraine is a big exporter of grains. We export about 15% of the total world market. And this could also influence overall food security in the world.
And a few final thoughts from Nick.
Well, people should know that it's a murder what we see now in our cities of Mariupol or Kharkiv, where we have people being there without possibility to leave the town. And Russia is bombing civilians, and about 150 children died just over last month. And this is unbelievable to see this in 21st century. It is a big tragedy for Ukraine and for the world to see what Putin and his regime is doing here. I appreciate you keeping Ukraine in your thoughts and prayers, and also thank you for the possibility to share with your audience the time you're going through. Thank you.
Ukrainian farmer Nick Gordichuk, my thanks to Ag Day's Clinton Griffiths for sharing that interview. That's the business of food on 720 WGN.
Amy Guth joins us to talk about all kinds of things. Hey, Amy, how are you? Ah, Amy's on the phone. Hi, Amy. How are you?
Hi there. How are you today?
I'm good. So jobless claims, let's talk about where we are on that.
Yeah, let's start there. So the jobless claims came in a little bit lower than economist predictions. The prediction was around 200,000 or so. But the Labor Department numbers that were reported earlier today came in about 166,000 for the week ending April 2nd. What's notable about this is also earlier today, the Labor Department announced some changes to its methodology. So right when the pandemic first started here, the department changed the way it calculated the seasonal adjustments. That was always kind of the phrase we heard when we were looking at labor numbers because of just the big swings in that data. And so they have announced that they're moving back now that the claims have fallen back to levels that we saw before the pandemic. They're moving back to the way they calculated that before. So we might see, we're going to see a little more perhaps stability in those numbers, hopefully, but also the way they arrive at those numbers will be a little bit different now.
Twitter confirms it's working on an edit button. Somebody else mentioned that this week on this show, but what else do you know about this?
So, you know, right after we talked about this, kind of the possibility of it, we talked about this on Tuesday, it was later that afternoon that a tweet came from Twitter saying that they are going to experiment with this. They said that they've been looking at this for more than a year. And so Twitter Blue is the subscription service. And so for people that want to pay for Twitter, they get access to some early features and some other perks. And so they said that they are going to be rolling out testing with this edit button for Twitter Blue customers in their lab section in the coming months to see what works, what doesn't, and kind of how it all shakes out. So I think that's really interesting. That is something that people have been asking for a very long time on Twitter. So I think it'll be very interesting to see how that rolls out and then what their timeline is once they, you know, learn what they need to learn from the Twitter Blue lab space.
So we don't have a definitive when and how yet, huh?
No, all they said was in the coming months in Twitter Blue lab. So we'll see. Maybe they'll learn a lot really quickly and be able to roll that out to the rest of us.
Boeing, you follow the airline industry pretty closely. What's the latest on that front?
Yeah, certainly. So Bloomberg reported earlier that Boeing is hiring three really big names in the cloud computing space, Amazon, Microsoft, and Google, to help with sort of an internal digital makeover. The idea is to give their designers of planes and their software developers more tools. And part of that is sort of this reboot is to help address some quality lapses that we've talked about so much over the last couple of years and some production issues. Of course, that would be a cost-saving measure if they get a handle on that. So there's no price tag that was named on this, but last year, a site called The Information reported that Amazon, Google, and Microsoft were competing for a contract that wasn't named, but it was a contract worth more than $1 billion over several years. So there's a lot of industry watchers that were kind of speculating that perhaps this is that contract. Unclear if it is, but I'm sure it's not a small price tag. But we'll see what this does for Boeing and how it moves the needle for some of their internal operations after, you know, we've seen so many of their quality issues kind of come to light over the last couple of years.
That's Amy Guth on the Wintrust Business Lunch. We'll talk again. Thank you, Amy.
Thanks so much, John.